Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. So much news to cover today, including the first doses of the coronavirus vaccine here in Massachusetts. But we want to start by taking you to the room where it happens, because right now in the State House, Massachusetts electors are meeting to cast the state's 11 Electoral College votes for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in the 2020 presidential election. WBUR Steve Brown is there in the House chamber and joins us now. Steve, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Tiziana.
So, Steve, we should mention you're using your golf voice because you really are right there, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm in the reporter's gallery, which is over the House chamber. We can look down from up here and see what's going down on the floor. The ceremony began just about 8 minutes ago. Bill Galvin, Secretary of State, gaveled the Electoral College session into session. And now they're going through so a lot of paperwork. You know, he's telling people there are 10 electors right now. There will be 11. They have to fill a vacancy. But they're, you know, telling them to take their paperwork out and start filling things out and things like that. It's all prescribed. It's all, they're following a script. And I'm not expecting any surprises here today.
Sounds important, but not glamorous, Steve. So really, this is going to be paperwork and turning some papers in?
Yeah, basically, they fill out ballots and they hand them in, and then they count. There's not a lot to count, obviously. There are only 11 electors, so they will count that, and they will announce that presumably Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been the elected president and vice president here in Massachusetts, and then eventually those votes will be put down to Washington.
So you said presumably, Steve. Does that mean there's concern about so-called faithless electors?
No, not really. As a reporter, I never say something is definitely going to happen because, you know, you never know that minute chance. I don't think it's going to happen. But, hey, you know, I don't want to say definitely until it's a done deal.
So again, for our listeners, Steve Brown is joining us live from the House chamber where the Electoral College is meeting right now. You talked about that empty chair, Steve. That's for Ronald Valerio. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. He was one of the 11 electors. He's from Auburn, and he unexpectedly died last Tuesday. He was one of the 11 electors, so that means that there is a vacancy. They have a seat for him here. They have flowers at that seat where he would have been sitting, and they did have a moment of silence at the beginning of this session, and they will be eventually choosing one of the alternates to fill in. So this still will be 11 votes cast for president.
So in every way, 2020 is an unusual year. You observed the Electoral College 4 years ago. What's different?
Yeah, usually this is a big show. They'll have a choral group in, and they'll have, you know, every seat in the gallery will be filled. I mean, on the floor, there's 160 seats on the floor of the House. They can bring in extra chairs. They can probably fit 200, 225 on the floor. You get maybe another 300 in the gallery. The room is packed, and there's usually a lot of enthusiasm for what's going on. But today, because of social distancing and everything, the room is kind of empty.
So, of course, 4 years ago, Massachusetts cast its votes for Hillary Clinton, but knowing Donald Trump won the election, this time around, they're casting votes for Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, who will win. Does that change the mood among Democrats in the room?
I think so, but since there's so few people here, you don't feel that energy that you would have felt otherwise. Because, you know, as I say, when I was here 4 years ago, it was sort of a Pyrrhic victory for the Democrats here. Yeah, if Hillary Clinton would get those votes, but, you know, they knew in the long run that come January, Donald Trump would be sworn in as president. So there was the air was let out of the room at that time. Here, you know, today, if we weren't in the midst of a pandemic, this room would be filled. We'd have the choral groups. We'd have the fancy clothes that they'd be wearing there. A little bit about that. Usually the electors wear formal wear because of the situation today. It's all casual dress, or not casual dress, but you know, wearing suit and tie and
business casual
and
kind of stuff.
Business casual. Thank you. That's the term I was looking for.
Well, that is WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown speaking quietly as he looks down in the House chamber where Massachusetts electors are meeting to cast the state's 11 Electoral College votes. Steve, thanks for joining us. Fun to be in the room with you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Hundreds of businesses in Massachusetts put their employees at risk by violating COVID-19 rules. That is one of the takeaways from complaints of alleged safety violations filed with the Department of Labor Standards and the State Attorney General's Office. WBUR's investigations team has been looking closely at the complaints and finds four industries on the top of the list: retail, restaurants, gyms, and salons. Now, as we face a holiday season that's critical to small business survival and increasing shut businesses down again during a second infection surge, it raises the question, what's behind the complaints and are businesses on balance keeping employees safe? So here to break it down for us is WBUR Shannon Dooling, who is part of the investigations team that broke the story. Shannon, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you and the investigations team tracked complaints made to the Department of Labor Standards Coronavirus Hotline. And I understand the dates were mid-May through December 1st. What does the number of complaints tell us about workplace safety standards? And what do we know about who's making them?
Well, I think for starters, it's important to note these are complaints about alleged violations of COVID workplace safety standards that someone took the time to, you know, pick up the phone and make a call to this hotline to file them. So it's, first of all, safe to assume these numbers do not represent the whole picture, right? It's just like a slice of working conditions right now. We know that complaints are filed anonymously by employees or customers or maybe former employees. And so we focused our reporting on the complaints that were investigated and that then led to actual violations of state safety standards. And so that's where we get those four industries you just mentioned at the top. 74% of the complaints that led to violations of safety standards were in retail, restaurants, gyms, and salons.
Okay, so companies who faced enforcement, what are they saying?
Well, some of the companies point to, you know, how fluid the situation is, how challenging it can be to keep up to date with the state's changing regulations, the local cities and towns regulations. I mean, we're just hearing now that Mayor Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, is rolling back some safety precautions having to do with some indoor, indoor spaces, whether that be museums or movie theaters. You know, those are closing once again. So it just kind of goes to show that this is a really fluid situation. And so some companies that have had clusters of cases pop up, they question, you know, how can we even be sure that our employees got COVID-19 on the job? And I mean, actually, speaking of clusters, we know now that there were 45 examples of the state finding violations after someone complained about a potential cluster or a positive COVID case. So again, we see a lot of restaurants, a number of gyms included in that. At Somerset-based Horner Millwork, they're a custom manufacturer of doors and windows and kitchens. The outbreak there began with just two positive cases in April. Here's Peter Murphy. Peter Humphrey. He's owner of Horner Millwork.
It kind of multiplied on us through early November, when I would estimate we had 20 plus cases, probably 60 to 80 people additionally that were out because they were contact traced.
So, Tiziana, the Department of Labor Standards did cite Horner Millwork for not cooperating with the state's contact tracing program. Humphrey, the owner, says his company, you know, to his knowledge, is now up to date with information sharing. But he also admits that they probably should have implemented a mandatory mask policy sooner. That's something they didn't do until this fall.
And, you know, you just mentioned the press conference that Mayor Walsh is having this hour will bring listeners more information on any rollbacks a little bit later. Just briefly, Shannon, in context, more than 1,000 companies and gathering places got complaints. Is that a big number? What do experts say?
Well, we know of the 1,300 complaints that were filed between mid-May and December 1st, a little less than half of them, about 46%, led to the state finding one of these violations of safety standards. And so labor and worker advocates believe that's way too high. We ran all of this by Jody Sugarman-Brosen. She heads up the Mass Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health.
Workers have to complain to start any kind of investigation or process. Retaliation is high. We're relying on workers to protect themselves, and it's just not working.
So it's not working, she says. So are advocates pushing specific reforms, remedies? What happens?
Well, we heard from labor representatives who are asking for more access to free COVID testing on site at places of employment, stricter standards that are informed by, you know, talking with actual employees on the ground level, above and beyond, following, you know, recommendations that are coming out from the CDC and the state.
All right. That is WBUR investigative reporter Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
The coronavirus vaccine rollout in Massachusetts has officially begun. I have seen the word hope in social media more times today than I probably have in a month. That's because vaccines from Pfizer arrived at Boston Medical Center early this morning, and the first vaccine was administered in New York to national attention. Then, just after noon today, World War II veteran Margaret Clessens, who is 96 years old, became the first VA patient nationwide to receive the vaccine at the VA Bedford Healthcare System in Massachusetts. Are you feeling hopeful? Does this feel like a moment for you? Did you see something shift for you today? Or maybe you have lingering questions that you'd like to ask a doctor about the vaccine? And tell us what it would mean for you and your loved ones to be vaccinated. Join this conversation. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So joining us now to have this conversation is WBUR's Common Health Editor, Carrie Goldberg, and Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Carrie, Dr. Barocas, welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you.
It's Tiziana.
Right? Exactly, Carrie. All right. So let's just jump in there. Are you happy today? Are you feeling excited?
So, yes, I have to admit that I am. I feel like this is a historic moment. It's a landmark vaccination effort. And it's the first glimmerings of relief, because it's looking like the end could be in sight, even though it's still quite a ways off. Right. It feels a little bit like the one small step thing on the moon, you know, that adds up to one giant leap for humanity, because we have these little mundane little shots going out. But at the same time, we've got this great new defense, and we're going to beat this virus back. So yes, I'm happy.
So Dr. Barocas, there's this video today of Sandra Lindsay, who is a critical care nurse at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, one of the first Americans to receive the vaccine. Here's what she said about how she was feeling today.
Hopeful. I feel hopeful today. Relieved. I feel like healing is coming. I hope this marks the beginning to the end of a very painful time in our history.
So how are you? I mean, were you moved? I mean, the vaccine came into BMC this morning.
Yeah, I'll be perfectly honest here. When I watched that video, I don't know, half a dozen times, each time trying not to get teary eyed, and it didn't happen. You know, this is for everyone. This has been a very, very long year, almost to the day, right, that all of this news broke. This has been a very long and difficult and trying year. And I think that's one of those videos that will replay over and over just to get good feelings. But I do want to say a couple things. First and foremost, there have been, and I think it's important to remember, there have been thousands of people who have received this vaccine through clinical trials. This is just the one that knew that she was getting the vaccine. And I want everyone to keep that in mind, is that this is a tested and safe vaccine that thousands of people have already gotten.
Yeah, to that point, we did our Radio Boston Week in Review on Friday, and one of our regulars, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, told us on the show on Friday for the first time that she had participated in a trial. She said, I think she said, I hope the one I got was the vaccine. But it is interesting that now we know there are thousands who have gotten it. And yet there is this kind of, as you say, Dr. Barocas, moment here. So, Carrie, we're talking about BMC, Dr. Barocas's institution. Why were they the first? Lots of big medical buildings and hospitals. I couldn't think of the word I wanted there. Why BMC first?
Well, I think we don't know that they're the first. We know that they're among the first that we're hearing about. So WBUR's Martha Biebinger has been reporting that they got two trays early this morning with 975 doses each to begin delivering this week. And they do expect to start in the next day or two and to get through about 1,000 vaccinations by Saturday. But we're hearing that hospitals across the state are expecting to get their shipments, you know, today, tomorrow, the day after. So they're part of a great big trend.
And this comes, Carrie, as we're in the midst of some of the darkest days of the pandemic. The infections are surging across Massachusetts, but today is a ray of hope. Actually, let me turn to you on this, Dr. Barocas. How do we balance those? Like, as we calibrate for ourselves, the extent to which in this moment we should be feeling anxious about the surge we're in and hopeful about what the vaccine could mean for us, how do we calibrate that?
You know, I'm not a very good runner, but and I can't do very long distances. But from what I hear from people who have run marathons is that when you round that last, you know, you head into the last 5 miles or so of a marathon, I'm told that it's both the most painful part of the race, and it's also a little bit of extra adrenaline kicks in, something in your body kicks in. And I think, you know, we've heard that analogy over and over this year that this is a marathon, not a sprint. And I actually think that this is that moment where we're hitting that the last 5 miles. It is painful, and there is nothing fun about the last 5 miles. There's nothing fun about what's going on. We are tired, and we are lonely, we're depressed, we're anxious, but at the same time, you know that the end of the race is coming. You know that all you have to do is keep it up for just a little bit longer, and you'll hit the finish line.
And Tiziana,
so Carrie, jump in.
Just the light at the end of the tunnel is getting pretty tattered as a metaphor. But in fact, you know, we are in pretty dark days right now in terms of the pandemic. We're seeing, you know, about 4,000 new confirmed cases a day statewide over the last couple of weeks. We've had a few days now of over 40 deaths a day. Right now, we've got nearly 1,600 COVID patients in the state's hospitals. So it is dark right now, and yet there is, as Dr. Barocas was saying, we can see that light ahead, and it's a question of getting there.
So let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Ellen on the line from Brookline. Ellen, what's on your mind?
Two things. Number one, my doctor wanted me to have, in April, have a tetanus shot. And I remember that they, like, now they're giving away, you know, but at the same time, you know, having to have the you know, the COVID.
The vaccine?
And, yeah, right. And but see, the thing is that number one, the tetanus, like you just said, a TD thing, like you said, I could get that and let's say, like I go down to
So water. Ellen, excuse me for interrupting. Ellen, yeah, so let me just ask you so I can get an answer for you. Did you get the tetanus shot?
No, I didn't get it. What happened was she gave me I had my physical, and I have the sheets here with everything and the directions. And she said I mean she made it sound like I could get it, you know, any time in April. In other words, you know, she said I'd have to get everything at once.
Yep, let's take it back from you there, Ellen, so that Dr. Barocas can tell us what he does or doesn't know about that particular question. Thanks.
Yeah, so I think that Ellen brings up a really good point, that right now This is just one more vaccine, just another vaccine. We're learning a lot more. I would encourage everyone that to stay on their regular vaccination schedule. So if your doctor is recommending, for instance, the tetanus vaccine, it's proper. It's good. It's good practice to get that vaccine. Sometimes those things can be deferred if that's what your doctor says is reasonable. But there's no reason, at least at this point, that we should be deferring other vaccinations or that we should be deferring this one from anyone that is offered it.
So
at least from what I've seen, there has not been any reported adverse events from, you know, multiple vaccinations.
And that's quite all right, Dr. Brokus. Glad to have you answer the question. If you have a question, or if you just want to join with us in reflecting on what feels like a very big day in the year of the pandemic, you can call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Joshua Brokus and WBUR's Carrie Goldberg, I'm going to ask you to stand by for a second. We've got some breaking news. And so I'm going to turn away from you just for a second. WBUR's Simone Rios is with us. He has been covering a press conference that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is having this hour, where the mayor has just been speaking about the coronavirus. Simone, what do we know from the mayor?
So Marty Walsh came on just a few minutes ago, sounding very concerned. He's been in touch with Boston area hospitals, and the news that they're getting is not good. He says, you know, these trends don't stop. It's going to be a very difficult winter for our hospitals. So the Boston Public Health Commission has issued a new order, sort of rolling back the reopening. Going into what they call a modified phase two, step two of the reopening for at least 3 weeks. So what that means is museums, theaters, aquariums, even spaces, you know, close to, you know, for gyms, for example, are going to be closed. One-on-one training is one thing that's going to continue. It's all kinds of, you know, outdoor activities, low contact, sporting facilities like bowling alleys, batting cages, rock climbing, all these things will be closed. And the effort here is really to reduce activity outside the home. And again, after 3 weeks, the city's going to reevaluate sort of where we're at with the virus and then potentially make changes at that point.
Okay, so Simone, so the headline there, also the 3 weeks I'm queuing in on. This is a different rollback than Governor Baker did last week, where he took the state back to phase three, step one. This is bigger. Is it a direct result of Thanksgiving?
You know, the mayor didn't say specifically what the reasoning was. He reiterated the gravity of the situation, the need for social distancing, the need for hand washing to continue to respect these guidelines. One thing that he did touch on was, you know, for customers of small businesses to be part of the solution. We hear so many stories about small businesses struggling. Walsh is saying, you know, continue to support them, whether that's through, you know, ordering food online, however they may be changing their business model. And so he's calling on the public to support small businesses in that way. You know, one more thing that he mentioned about small businesses, there's going to be webinars starting tomorrow morning where the businesses can hear from city officials about the changes.
And just to clarify, Simone, indoor dining still a go, yes?
It is, although, you know, with the space requirements that have already been in place, one thing that does change is apparently there's not going to be any seating at bars. So that's okay. That is a significant change. Although Walsh specified that there can be special permission granted from the city to issue a waiver for that.
WBUR Simone Rios joining us from the press conference with Mayor Marty Walsh. Simone, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So I'm turning back to Dr. Joshua Brokus of Boston Medical Center and WBUR's Common Health Editor, Carrie Goldberg. Let me just get the reactions from the two of you to that news. Carrie.
Well, I was just starting to say what's most striking to me is that indoor dining continues, which is sort of what people have most been watching for, is whether it would be shut down because it is thought to be a significant contributor to transmission. But apparently it still will not be.
And does that surprise you, Dr. Baroukas?
A little. And I was listening intently to that, too, along with Carrie, that, you know, I'm encouraged. I think that it is a time to roll back and to put in place some restrictions in the places that we know that there's a high likelihood of transmissibility. And so I do think that this sort of scalpel approach, if you will, to restrictions is appropriate. We want to make sure that people's livelihoods can continue. I hope that there are resources that are coming to small businesses, and I'm very sort of, I would say, a little perplexed as to why we're not rolling back indoor dining yet, given all of the information and the data that's coming out. I honed in a little bit on that 3 week number two, and I'm struck because I know that that Boston Public Schools are hoping to come back to school at least hybrid at the beginning of the year. So I wonder if there's any thought behind that and putting these restrictions in place to get schools back open.
And just to note for listeners, today the Boston Public Schools welcomed back 1,700 additional students who are special needs learners or English as a second language learners into the school. So there has been a little bit of a change there. We are observing what Carrie Goldberg talked about at the top of the segment as Vaccine Day today with you. Call with your reactions to the rollout of the vaccine here in the Commonwealth today. And we have Dr. Joshua Baroukas here. So your questions about vaccination as well. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. Let's go to Tracy in Andover. Tracy, go ahead.
I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say I work in an elementary school, and I'm just so looking forward to taking the vaccine. I'm so excited for the day when all our students can come back to school and we can have everybody together again. It's been a really challenging year, and this has just given me a little bit of hope for the future. So thank you.
That is joyful, Tracy, and thanks for sharing your excitement with us. Carrie Goldberg, we know that there are three phases to the vaccine rollout, and where do teachers fit in all of that?
Teachers are, I think, in phase two. So basically, we've got, you're right, we have three phases, and they're kind of basically decided by your level of risk, like how likely are you to catch it and how bad would it be for you if you did? That's sort of the overwhelming considerations. So phase one, which is starting today, I guess you could say, includes healthcare workers, the first responders, residents and staff of what's called congregate care settings like nursing homes, also prisoners and prison staffers. And then phase two is expected to start in February, and that's people who are at high risk for complications, people who work in education, so that would be Tracy, and grocery stores and other jobs that are considered essential, and also then adults over 65. And then phase three is basically everybody, and that's expected to start in April, according to the state. So you know, coming weeks is how I think of it. Just hang on for these coming weeks.
And can I add, I think I share in Tracy's excitement for schools to get going again and for everything to sort of start to equilibrate back to some semblance of normal. I think that it's really important that everyone remember, though, that this is literally just the beginning, right? We have really only vaccinated a handful of people not in clinical trials. And we have a long ways to go. As was mentioned earlier by Carrie, our hospitals are full. You know, field hospitals are open in Rhode Island. We are still in a very dire and stressed time for the healthcare system. It is not a good picture inside those walls. So while this is a very nice, I love the vaccine day statement, and this is a great thing. We still have, and I know it's really hard, but we really have to keep trying to maintain all of these preventive actions that we've we've talked about for the last, you know, 9-10 months, and sort of support the community that way.
A very good reminder to temper, you know, my joy with the reality of the moment. And I do also, you talked about the field hospitals in Rhode Island, Dr. Barocas, you know, there's a field hospital up and running again in Worcester, and the state is in the process of bringing one up, standing one up in Lowell as well. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Brian on the line in Somerville. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi, good afternoon. I kind of wanted to almost, you know, continue on that theme. You know, I'm very hopeful this is a great day. The fact that we have vaccines going into Americans. I'm scared because, you know, I don't know that we're doing enough to prevent the next pandemic. And, you know, we've had clusters of pandemics in the past. And, you know, how do we know that, you know, the next pandemic isn't coming in 2021 or 2022? Like, how do we know, you know, how do we take the steps that we've learned from this pandemic to, you know, prevent the next one?
It's a good question, Brian. Thank you. Dr. Barocas, I'll turn to you first, and then Carrie, you may have some you want to add on that too. Dr. Barocas.
Yeah, I think that Brian brings up a really good point, right? We are, unlike when we were, you know, in the 1918 flu, we are seeing pandemics coming with some amount of regularity now. And there are a number of reasons behind that. But for the moment, at least there's, you know, there is another epidemic. There are multiple epidemics going on right now across the world. We have Ebola. We still have tuberculosis throughout the world. We have HIV, and of course, we also have the overdose epidemic. These are things that we are unfortunately having to contend with. I think that there will be a lot of new policies and a lot of new insight that are gained as we sort of start to close the chapter, the book on this one. I share Brian. All I can say is I share Brian's concerns. This is something that unfortunately I think we or our children or our children's children are going to have to start to understand as part of life. But for the moment, I think I would encourage Brian to say we are in this moment. We have to make it through this one. There are established ways that we can make it through this one. And now there's one more tool in the toolbox to do so. And not to punt the question too far down the road, because we can't, but I don't want to lose sight of where we are right this moment.
And Carrie, in your reporting, have you come across discussion of these kinds of concerns and how our medical community is keeping its eye on that ball?
Yes. So I take heart from a couple of things. One is that we have learned some very painful lessons in this pandemic. And I think that our governments and our populations are absolutely intent on doing better. The first one is that our public health system, you could barely even call it a system. It had not gotten nearly enough funding for decades. And I suspect that we're going to see a big infusion of money into our public health systems and a buildup to be much more able to respond to a pandemic like this. And the other thing I would note is that the scientists that I interview are absolutely pinching themselves. They are flabbergasted at how quickly the scientific community responded to this bug. And so they, you know, they sequenced its genome within days or weeks, and then they immediately got to making the vaccine. And this mRNA vaccine platform seems to be usable for other things as well. And so there's a lot to be heartened by in terms of the scientific progress that is both behind how we responded to this pandemic and how we will respond to the next one.
So Dr. Barocas, we had a couple questions come in on the line about pregnancy and newborns. One about whether it is recommended for a pregnant woman to be vaccinated because they were not in the trial. And the other asking about risks for women who are actively nursing babies to get the vaccine. Can you answer those questions?
Yeah, those are good questions. So, both the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, as well as the Society of Maternal and Fetal Medicine, came out with statements saying that while pregnant women were not part of the trial. Certainly, they should be offered the vaccine once it is available to whatever phase they're in. And unfortunately, we don't have safety data necessarily on it. But everything that I have read and all of the discussions that I've had with people in the vaccine world and in the obstetrics world is that pregnant women can receive the vaccine after a discussion of risks with their physician.
So Carrie Goldberg, Dr. Barocas, was reminding us of the sober moment that we're in, even as we get excited about and look to the hope that the vaccine brings us. So good time to just in 30 seconds or so, remind us all about the safety practices that remain important and the guidance from the state that remains important as we're in that last 5 mile stretch, to use Dr. Barocas's running analogy.
Yes. So we are hearing absolutely universally from health officials that you must continue doing all the things you've heard a million times you have to do. So masking and social distancing and hand washing. And I would just add that, just as today we're celebrating Vaccine Day, I'm really looking forward to the day when we are all so vaccinated and so immune that we can actually have what we will call unmasking day. And I personally plan to burn at least one of my masks, although I'll keep others in case there's another pandemic. But anyway, so we are not at unmasking day yet, as we all know.
And that is WBUR's Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg and Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Great to have you both with us to mark this moment today. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
This is the season of lots of things, but also when folks at the Massachusetts-based Merriam-Webster Dictionary tell us which word mattered the most. It's their word of the year. So over the break, did you try to guess? Well, it is pandemic. And among the other top words for 2020, coronavirus, defund, icon, malarkey, quarantine, and a new, or a perennial New England fave, irregardless. So joining us now for some word fun is Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster Dictionary. He's in Springfield, joins us from there. Peter, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
So, the speed of the story this year we thought was going to be the vaccine. We now have pandemic as the word of the year. But I was also really interested to find out that the word COVID-19 has a record-breaking story this year, too. Tell us about that.
Well, none of us had ever heard that word a year ago, for sure. Mm-hmm. And it was coined by the World Health Organization to name this disease in February of this year. And we saw in our dictionary data, we have 100 million page views a month at the website and 2 billion lookups a year on our app. So a lot of data coming in. And many people were looking this new term up, but there was no entry, not only in our dictionary, there was no entry in any dictionary for that term. But our science definers had noticed the term in January and February when it was coined and had drafted a definition, and we decided to have a kind of emergency release to put out a few words that were associated with the pandemic, including COVID-19 itself, and to make them available immediately rather than to wait for our normal publishing schedule. And so the record was set at 34 days between coinage and entry into our dictionary.
Wow. And how much faster is that than, let's say, the old record?
Well, the former record was back in the days of print when we still sell print dictionaries. But in 1984, we added the word AIDS, and that was about 2 years after the term was coined. But that had to go through the entire production process of typesetting and distribution and getting the books onto the bookshelves. So that was a little bit longer. But for the same reason, you can see that these were two terms that were of real significant importance to the public, and there was an urgent sort of necessity to get those definitions into the dictionary.
So some interesting parallels there, and interesting to know that COVID, which of course its spread became our global pandemic, had a sort of a linguistic moment this year as well. Now to the word of the hour, pandemic. I know it's not a surprise that that was the big word this year, but in reading up for to talk to you, I was kind of stunned at the magnitude of that word this year. Can you give people some sense of how big the word pandemic became in 2020?
Sure. I mean, looking back at the data, and our word of the year is a statistical analysis of which words sent people to the dictionary during the previous year, and we noticed something for the first time when we looked at this data, which was there was a little uptick on January 20th, which was the date of the first positive case in the United States. You could see the word starting to go up, but then on February 3rd, the day that the first COVID patient in the United States was released from a Seattle hospital, that was when there was a significant look up, about 1,600% over a year before that. But then the big day was in March when the World Health Organization officially declared that COVID-19 can be characterized as a, quote, pandemic. And that's the day that the word had a 806% lookup increase over that same day last year, which is astonishing, almost 116,000% increase. And so what you see here is a couple of things. First of all, when a word seems suddenly technical or legal or medical, that drives people to the dictionary. And pandemic might be a word in our general vocabulary, but only in a general way. When it suddenly seems to affect our daily lives, that specificity, that urgent specificity, is what sends people to the dictionary.
So I'm listening to you talk about, 100,000 times more. Mm-hmm. And there's something, I know that that's in retrospect, right? We look back now and we see that that was the searching, but there is something ominous to that. Because, I love me some words. I would be interested in whatever word you wanted to bring to the show today. But for the person who may not be as much, engaged with the dictionary, this idea of words and how language affect us, it's something like the pandemic as a word really is a window into our psyche, our collective lived experience this year, our souls, our worries. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, absolutely. And sometimes with words, of course, the words themselves have stories. The story of a word, its biography is its etymology, its own history. And pandemic, pan in Greek, means all or every. And demos, it means the population or people. So all of the people is what pandemic means. And it connects it to the word epidemic, which means on or upon the people, or endemic, which means in or within the people. So within the people, on the people, all the people. And it's interesting and important to note also that demos, the dem part of pandemic, is the same dem that's in democracy or demagogue, population or populace or people. And so this is a word that that means affecting all of us. And that's really the profound nature of this of this disease, of course, but it's also the profound nature of the sort of cultural response. We all had to stay home. Many businesses had to close. Obviously the consequences were immediate. As it happens, and I'm sure my story is not unique at all, March 11th was the date that this disease was declared a pandemic. The 12th, my company had a practice work from home day just to make sure that we all had connections. And that evening, we got an email that said, don't come back. And we haven't been back since. So the fact is that that 24-hour period was a really momentous one for all of us.
So, to that point, some of the other pandemic-related words this year, quarantine, asymptomatic, coronavirus. Quarantine was the one I thought of. Obviously, staying at home from work was more a safety precaution or, a shelter in place. But these words start to emerge. You've already told us what it means and how we know and why they emerge when we're having a moment in history. Do they now become sort of a thing of their own after there's the linguistic star rises on a word? Do we start to use it to mean other things and borrow it in other contexts? Will we see these words stay with us in the front of our psyche even after, hopefully, as we heard in the last segments, the masks come off and we're finally starting to live a life that is post COVID-19?
Sure. I mean, by comparison, in 2009, our word of the year was bailout, because the Great Recession was underway and bailout was in the news. And again, it had a kind of technical quality in that moment, and it was urgent. But when we talk about that period, we don't call it the bailout. However, in this case, I think 10 years hence, we probably will refer to this as the pandemic. So not only is this a global consequence of the medical emergency, but there is this idea that we've named something. And it may well be that the word pandemic achieves a secondary meaning, that is to say, specifically this disease, this moment in time, this time that we all share. And it's true that there are categories of words, some words that have to do with sort of governmental response, like quarantine, or, you know, when this first happened, we saw terms like lockdown and draconian, and even martial law being looked up. So those are kind of governmental responses. And then there are medical terms like coronavirus, pandemic, and vector, and virus that were looked up. And then there's also these other words that were just sort of the public's response, words like apoplectic or Kafkaesque or tragedy or surreal. These are terms that people were looking up in the dictionary when the reality of this first sort of hit. The thing about the word pandemic is that not only was it high in March, it remained high all year long, so that this is clearly the word of the year. It's just something that people have been thinking about, and they go back to the dictionary to confirm or get more nuance and information about.
So our nation's racial reckoning was the other big story this year, and I noticed that the third word on the list was defund. Also,
Absolutely.
Icon, Mamba were big words this year. Connect the dots for us, for our listeners. We have about a minute and a half.
Yeah, sure. What sends people to the dictionary is often the news, but it's often sports or entertainment. But in this case, of course, a very news-filled year, defund the police. Defund is an interesting issue, because the news question was always, what does it mean? You know, what mm-hmm. did you want? What did you express by that? Our dictionary definition simply means to remove funding from. So there's no answer there about the specificity of police funding. However, it sent people to the dictionary for clarity. Icon, of course, referring both to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Congressman John Lewis, who both died this year. And the word icon was used in so many memorials and obituaries for those two figures. And Mamba is from the Zulu word meaning a very fast kind of snake that was Kobe Bryant's nickname. And the death of a sports star is a shock to the country. And this unusual word sent many people to the dictionary. And the fact is, it's a good indicator to show what people are thinking about according to which words send them to the dictionary from the news. It's sort of a prism through which to view the news with vocabulary.
Peter, is there one word, just briefly, that was fun for you this year?
Well, the word malarkey, of course, has been associated with the president-elect Biden. He's been using it in his debates for years, and we've noted that over time. My favorite, of course, is the word irregardless, which many people were upset about to discover that it was in our dictionary, apparently new to the dictionary. In fact, we first entered it in 1934. It's a word that's, that we enter in the dictionary because the job of the dictionary is to tell the truth about words, not to be the traffic cop, but to report the facts. And, of course, the fact is this is a word that exists. This may be a hypercorrection or an error. We do recommend in the dictionary that you probably should not use this word if you care about the way that your writing is going to be judged, if it's academic or professional. But it's a fun word, and it's about language, and that's what sends people to the dictionary too.
Well, and irregardless, we are out of time. That's Peter Sokolowski, editor at large of Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.